Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, June 20th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. In just a little bit, we're going to have a chat with neuroscientist, professor, and television host, Dr. Heather Berlin. But before we do, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. If you've ever wondered about the names that I call out at the beginning of the episode, those are individuals who have visited my Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/talknerdy. And they've pledged to support the show on an episodic basis. There are a lot of different levels of support, all the way down from like $1 or 50 cents up to levels that give you certain perks like free merchandise from the store, signed photos, of course, a personal shout out at the top of the show every week. And the reason for this is because I produce and run Talk Nerdy all by myself. I don't work with a podcasting company. Nobody hosts my show for me. Nobody edits it. I have to do all the work. And obviously, I don't charge to be able to listen to the show. I want to make sure it remains 100% free for everybody who's interested. So of course, that relies on a model where those who want to support and those who can support can do it in an effort to make it easy for everybody to have access. So if you are interested in showing your support for the show, you can just visit patreon.com/talknerdy. It's looking like my next level, once I break a certain dollar amount, I can upgrade the show and do some things that'll help everybody enjoy it just a little bit more. I'm thinking my next level is going to involve having a transcriptionist work to ensure that all of the show notes are really thorough and anybody can read along with the show. So if we want to be able to make that happen, I rely on support of people like you. And like, let's see, this week, the show is actually made possible by Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Charles Payet, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much for your support week after week. Okay, guys, I'm really excited to sit down with this week's guest. She is a neuroscientist at Mount Sinai. She does really fascinating research that we're going to be talking about on the show, but she also plays her hand in media and is a co-host of the show Science Goes to the Movies. So here she is, without any further ado, Heather Berlin. Heather, thank you so much for joining me in my home studio.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited because I think that you might only be the second person, maybe third, since I've moved into the new house, who's recorded here. It's always fun. I've done so many remotes lately. It's really fun to have people
this
in
is
person.
For all you listeners, this is an awesome space. It's just like my fantasy space right here.
I love that we were geeking out about how we have like all the same books.
Yeah. And like the little, like the phrenology head. And it, yeah. Except you're way more organized than on my bookshelf.
Well, I also like am not juggling a full-time job and a family and doing the on-air work that you do. So for people who don't know, to give a little bit of background and then we'll dive into it. So you are a clinical scientist. Like, are you a cognitive scientist?
I'm a cognitive neuroscientist.
Cognitive neuroscience.
But okay. I do clinical research. So I do research with patients, both psychiatric patients and neurological patients. And I use neuroimaging and neurocognitive testing to do research with these patients.
So basically somebody, you know, bumps their head or somebody has a stroke or whatever clinical issue is going on, and then they're admitted into the hospital or they're there for outpatient, you can see them. And although you're not actively treating, you're assessing and you're doing research and you're learning from their conditions.
Right, exactly. So I think, you know, I mean, my goal is really to understand the brain and how it relates to the mind and how it all works. But when everything's working properly, it's harder to see what everything's doing. So when something breaks, you know, you're like, oh, that's what that thing was controlling or not. So I think you can learn a lot about how the mind and brain are related by looking at people who have brain lesions in specific parts of the brain and then seeing what cognitive deficit they have as a result.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of stuff I do with the neurological patients. And yeah, I'll get them from, they'll come into the hospital, either, you know, they had some kind of traumatic brain injury, head trauma, or a neurosurgical lesion. Let's say like they removed a tumor,
mm-hmm.
and we want to do testing before they go in for the surgery and then after and see what's changed. And that tells us what that part of the brain is involved in. But then I also work with psychiatric patients, mostly people with impulsive and compulsive disorders, like obsessive compulsive disorder. And we're trying to understand the neurocircuitry related to that disorder. So like we'll compare a group of people, let's say with OCD, to, you know, what we call healthy controls who mm-hmm. don't have any, I mean, there is no such thing as normal, but they don't have any clear like diagnosable disorder. And we'll, let's say, do different tests with them in the scanner and see, you know, what looks different.
So you do a lot of imaging studies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and we recently just built this, I'm like proud of it, we built this olfactometer, which there's only a few in the world that we can, it's specially designed that you can distribute scents in the scanner and look at what's happening to people's brain when they're smelling different odors. And so we've done that. Right now I'm just actually revising a paper, so hopefully it's going to be out published soon, but where we gave people with OCD, like contamination type OCD, different odors, either pleasant, like, you know, strawberry or banana, mm-hmm. and then unpleasant, like garbage or urine.
Poo-poo.
Yeah. Feces. Exactly. Yeah. That was one of them. And we looked at what happened to their brain. And what was interesting is that compared to healthy people, they have a much stronger reaction in their brain in a place called the insula, which is like a disgust that processes your feeling of disgust.
Interesting.
Too disgusting. So things just feel subjectively more disgusting to them. And it's really unique because it's looking at a psychiatric disorder, but saying that they might have actually primary sensory processing problems that could then lead to the more cognitive problems. So if you walk into a restroom and to you, it just feels so disgusting, you know, it's overwhelming, your brain is reacting, it's almost like hypersensitive, you'll start to want to avoid that, or you'll fear that, and or you'll hyper, you know, you'll clean it obsessively because you can't take the odor. So it might start as a sensory processing problem, and we're looking at treatments to maybe target those sensory processing problems that could then maybe lead to more of the, you know, helping with the more cognitive aspects of the disorder.
Yeah, that's fascinating because even in like normal controls, right, it's on a spectrum. Like if I walk into a restroom that I think is relatively clean, I might not have a disgust reaction because I don't really smell much and I don't really notice much. But if I'm in like a truck stop bathroom, I do weird things too. I do compulsive things and I put down paper and I don't touch the seat. And mm-hmm. and so imagine if what I consider a relatively clean bathroom appears to be more like a truck stop bathroom.
Yeah, it's exactly it. I mean, it's just all on a spectrum. And mm-hmm. it's like with everything, with disgust or, you know, with sensation seeking or impulsivity, we all fall somewhere on a spectrum. So mm-hmm. to really empathize with what these people are going through, it's imagine the way you feel in a truck stop is how they might feel in what you think is of a clean bathroom. And then, you know, then you can see that their behaviors actually are in line with what they're feeling.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you would react too if you were feeling that way. So, you know, a lot of what people are targeting is the cognitive aspect of the disorder, you know, which is important, you know, change how you're viewing things. But I think getting at that really basic level, and so what we're going to, the next sort of aspect of this is we want to do, we're starting to do with healthy subjects now is like neurofeedback,
mm-hmm.
where they're in the scanner and it's sort of like biofeedback, you know, they're getting real time feedback of what their insula activation is looking like. So we'll show them like a disgusting image. They'll get, let's say, increased insula activation, and we'll say, do whatever you can to kind of try to bring it down. And they can do it.
And so they'll physically see like a visual, a bar mm-hmm. go up, and then mm-hmm. they'll want to like lower it. And just by thinking, like quelling the disgust, they can actually change their brain activity.
Yeah. And so, and the great thing about it is it's that it's individualized. So we say, look, there are a number of different strategies you can use to try to decrease. You can like, there's distancing, you can sort of distance yourself from mm-hmm. it, or you can like reconceptualize what you're seeing. You know, we say, okay, there are these various strategies, but use whatever works for you. try various things. So it's really individualized, whatever they happen to hit upon. And just like how people can lower their heart rate,
yeah,
and they don't know exactly how, but they're managing to, like, with that feedback to get, yeah, it down. So it might even just be some unconscious things that they're doing, but they can do it.
Yeah. And people do those kinds of adaptive things all the time without even realizing they're doing it. Like, I'm really reminded of the experience of getting tattooed. I don't know if how many people listening to this have tattoos, but it's extended pain, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you'll sit there for maybe, if it's a big piece, like 8 to 10 hours with just this, you know, cutaneous, like, burning sensation. And you have these weird strategies where you'll, like, put yourself someplace else, or you'll, like, somehow, like, think through it, or you'll utilize the pain as some sort of goal-directed behavior, whatever it is. There are all these coping mechanisms that we already possess that we have to use when we're forced into that box.
Right.
So using them in a clinical setting is really interesting, because, of course, we could exercise those skills on command. We just don't think that we have those skills.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, people, I mean, listen, it's all within. So if you take somebody who is, like, highly anxious, you know, if you have an anxiety disorder, or let's say an extreme phobia, right? You're probably never, they're never going to become the most relaxed, chilled out person in the room.
Yeah, like somebody with, like, a really intense phobia of spiders is probably not going to, like, snuggle with tarantulas by the end of the, like, they're not going to be like, I want a pet tarantula.
Right, they might not, but you can definitely, within their, you know, bounds, you can definitely decrease that anxiety really significantly, to the point where, you know, they can pet a tarantula. I mean, they might not going to, you know, want them to crawl all over them, but...
But they're not going to, like, lose their shit when they find a spider in the house.
Yeah, exactly.
Capture it, release it, do the things that, like, people who don't have anxieties around that would normally do.
Exactly. And so I think we're much more capable than what we think of, like, we can do much more. But it's about finding the motivation. And it's also about facing your fears, because a lot of the therapy, let's say with a spider phobia, is we call it exposure response prevention. And so you actually have to have them confront the thing they're most afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
In steps, in stages, you know, what as much as they can take at each session. And over time, they see that nothing bad happens. And the brain, you're kind of like retraining the brain to kind of disassociate that anxiety from that particular stimulus. So you have to actually confront it. It's the same thing with flying. You know, you have to eventually get the person to fly.
To get on a plane.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is, we live in an era now where we have technology that allows for that, like you said, that step-by-step desensitization in a virtual sense. Like, we have cool VR programs where you can, like, see a spider, or you can get in a flight simulator and you don't have to leave the ground. And it actually really feels to you, like, when you're, that's all you can see and that's all you can hear, like, you're there. And it's such a nice way as a clinician. First of all, you don't have to go, like, take a flight with your patient, which would be weird.
Right. Which they've done.
They have done. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. There's actually a program in New York that I'm working with, and they would, like, literally have to pay, you know, and get the plane ticket and go on the flight.
Wow.
That's, like, the ultimate end result with the patient.
And, like, how prohibitive that is for, like, a lot of people, you know.
But, you know, it's getting so much better, because they're also, like, there's ones that we have now for PTSD where they're simulating, you know, the environments where these guys have been in. Like, they'll have one for Afghanistan or one for Iraq, and they have odors of, like, gunpowder. They have, like, a mock gun that you can hold. And so it's just it's incorporating all the senses, like tactile and olfactory, and they're so real. But still, ultimately, as good as that is, I think it's a great, like, first step.
Yeah.
You still have to eventually get to the real, you know.
You got
to
do it, or you've got to face it, you know, which is, because that's life.
Yeah. And it's hard. And so I think motivation is a key. Like, I think we can all have more control over, let's say, negative emotions that are interfering with our everyday functioning. But it takes work. You know,
of course.
It doesn't come easy. And it's almost like, I liken it to, like, people, let's say if you're an alcoholic, like, you're never fully cured. You always have to work at, you know, fighting that. If you have a predilection or a temptation, you know what that is, but you're always working against it. And, you know, you can keep yourself in a place where you're healthy, but it's not, I think people tend to slip back into problems when they become too complacent and they think, oh, I'm cured. And then
totally. And you can't be. It's like, I know that world really well, not because I actually don't drink and I never drank. Like, I've never had any issues with alcohol, but I was a smoker for many, many years. My mom was a smoker. I saw my mom smoking all the time when I was young. I started smoking at a really young age. And by the time I was probably 16, 17, I was, like, you know, always a pack in my purse, maybe a pack every 2 days. And I and I told myself I'm going to quit by the time I'm 30. And I actually quit earlier. I think I was like 26, 27 when I quit smoking, which was insane and huge. Wow. But like, I think the day it clicked for me was when I realized, like, I'm not going to quit until I want to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many times when you're struggling with addiction where you still want it in your life. And until you actually don't want it anymore, until the tape that it tips and you realize mm-hmm. like the bad of it is outweighing the good, you just won't mm-hmm. like, it's very hard to quit smoking, or I would assume to quit doing certain other substances if you're like, but I like it.
Yeah.
Like, this is my life and I like it. I'm not ready yet.
But that's still the first step. And I fully agree. You know, there's a lot of people who, you know, I deal with people who have what we call like behavioral addictions that are just as addictive. It's the same neurocircuitry involved with the drug. So like, you know, let's say it's shopping addiction
or gambling or
stealing or even skin picking or...
Yeah.
And it's all the same. It's like sometimes they're like, well, but I don't want to stop. Mm-hmm. I like it. You know, it's only when they get to the point where it's causing them a lot of anxiety and they feel like it's out of control. But that's still the first step, because even with, let's say when you decide, okay, I know I want to stop, it's still really difficult. You don't just stop one day because you want to.
Yeah. And you're still dealing with that kind of ambivalence. Like, mm-hmm. this is something that, you know, obviously I talk to with my shrink all the time, is like, one of the biggest goals in therapy is learning how to cope with like the fact that we're constantly in a state of ambivalence. Like, you can simultaneously want something and not want it, or mm-hmm. feel good about something and feel bad about it. And I think a big part of like psychological growth is realizing that about yourself and being okay with it. So as an addict, like, you might know you want to quit, but you still fucking want the thing.
Yeah.
And then you're struggling with those like opposing forces all the time.
And even when you quit, even if you've quit for years, let's say in mm-hmm. your case, I'm sure, I would imagine there are some times when you thought about like, oh, it would be really nice to have a cigarette right now.
It's when I see my brand. Fight that. It's so crazy. Oh, like, it's such a brand. Yeah. It's when I see a pack of Camel Red Lights mm-hmm. on a table, or I see some, because all other cigarettes are disgusting to me. But if I see, even that's if I so smell weird. Them, they smell really good to me.
Really?
And I remember I had a boyfriend at the time when I was, before I quit, but he gave me some really good advice. He was like, listen, back in the day when I quit smoking, this was my mantra. You can't even just have one.
No, exactly. The thing is, you know that consciously. Mm-hmm. And so one of the keys, and I talk about this a lot because I'm really interested in, So I study sort of like for my day job is what's the neural basis of impulsive and compulsive behavior. But the larger question that I'm really interested in, that's like the overarching umbrella of all of this, is what's the neural basis of these unconscious processes mm-hmm. versus conscious ones? And the unconscious processes are the things that are like, you know, Freud would call your id impulses. Like, I want instant gratification. Yeah. I want pleasure. I want to go for this thing. I want to avoid any pain or punishment. And that's a lot of what's being active in the, whether it is food addiction, sugar addiction, drug addiction. And then you have the prefrontal cortex, which is more recently evolved, which is kind of like thinking about the future consequences of your actions and the implications. And there's like a balance between these two systems. But, you know, either when you have the sort of id impulses, the subcortical kind of overriding that, you can have problems with impulse control, or the brake system is broken, you have a lesion. But what I often say is that the key is having the insight, is knowing what your unconscious kind of programs are, and then structuring your world around that. So like the greatest thing, like you said, is you know that when you see that brand, that's going to trigger you. Mm-hmm. And just knowing that can help you, like, you know, behaviorally, like, either avoid it or make sure that's not in your environment. Or let's say if you're a sweet tooth, don't have like sweets in the house, because if you know that you see it, you're not going to be able to resist that temptation.
It's like, don't even look at the dessert menu, or like, you know, you have to make those kinds of decisions. And unfortunately, it does seem like insight is correlated with higher functioning. So what ends up happening, really unfortunately, is that you have patients with like severe frontal lobe injury and they're just lacking all insight. And it's so hard to work with that. You know, it's so hard to overcome that, because it's like, can I do this now? No, you can't do that. But now can I do this? It's like, no, you still can't do that.
It's funny, you know, because like, I've worked with these patients who were inpatients. These were like severe prefrontal lesion patients. And the interesting thing is, like, they would just blurt out like what maybe, let's say like a male one might be thinking they want to hit on you. But like, if you had a fully functioning prefrontal cortex, you'd be like, maybe that's not appropriate. I shouldn't be hitting on like the person, my scientist. The doctor. Yeah. But they'll just like blurt out things that are really inappropriate, whatever. Yeah. And you have to just take it with a grain of salt because they don't have the ability to control it. And I mean, I have a 2.5-year-old and I often say to my husband, like when she just does like throws the food on the floor, despite us telling her not to, it's like, you have to give her a little bit of like leeway because she doesn't have a fully developed prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, so it's like she's learning those behaviors, but they're not learned yet. And she doesn't have the architecture to have them.
Yeah. And you know, it's so like you have a prefrontal lesion patient. It's similar to my 2-year-old. It's also similar to like my grandmother who, when she got really old, because a lot of times, you know, you have like frontal, you know, a bit of frontal dementia. And so, and it's the good thing about it is it's easy to distract them. So like if she gets upset about something, you can easily like almost like throw something shiny in front of her face and she'll like look over there. And so it's like whatever happens to be in front of you in the moment is what you're attending to. So if you learn this sort of a little bit of that skill of like how to, you know, so if this patient says something inappropriate, like change the topic, do something different, and they're not going to stick to it. They have a less sticky brain, so to speak, which is the opposite of, let's say, an OCD patient who actually has increased activation of the prefrontal cortex. So they tend to just like over, you know, obsess over and over, and they can't get over something. Whereas if you have a lesion, you know, on the downside, you're impulsive. On the plus side, you can easily like move on to something else.
Yeah, frontal lobe specifically, because it's so like the last thing to evolve and it has so much, I don't know, control over our control, has always fascinated me. Like when I first got into neuro, Oliver Sacks was like the reason I got into it, because I would read his books a lot. And I worked for a very short time doing like clinical assessment for a neuropsychologist. And it was kind of sad because it was all diagnostics. So we never got to actually see anybody get better. But, and I was doing research really, but he was, you know, the clinician. And I remember we had a patient and he specifically had, he had attempted suicide with a shotgun. And so he basically like blew through his frontal cortex and he blew through his optic nerves and he looked like a monster. Like he looked horrifying because he blew his face off. And so at that point he had some plastic surgery and was starting to look more normal. He had a seeing eye dog. He was highly, but this is the fascinating thing about him. He was highly functional and incredibly intelligent, but had like no frontal lobe to speak of. Mm-hmm. And so he was so fascinating to me because he would just actively blurt out the most inappropriate thing. He would curse. He would like say highly sexual things to you. And but he was smart enough and didn't really have a lot of insight, but was smart enough that when you would be like, you can't do that, it's inappropriate, that's where the boundary is. And he'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize. Like, I'm sorry, thanks for pointing it out to me. And I also remember there was this crazy kind of, I don't know, irony to his disorder because, so he had attempted suicide. That's how it happened because he was really depressed. And of course, blowing through his frontal lobes, in essence, cured his depression. Like when you would ask him what happened, he'd be like, oh, I was cleaning my gun. Like he had no insight that he had attempted suicide because he was the most happy-go-lucky person ever. And even though he actually physically looked monstrous to the outside world, like little kids would be kind of afraid of him, he had no idea. And he just like didn't care.
Right.
Which was it was like very sad. It was a cruel irony, but it was really fascinating to see this like free way that he was able to live his life after that because he was highly intelligent. You could play chess with him and you could have like these really complex conversations with him, but it was almost like a lobotomy.
Yeah.
You know?
Or where, you know, the interesting thing is that everybody responds differently. Like you can take two people and give them lesion the same place in their brain and they might have totally two different like, you know, changes in their disposition because depending on how things are wired, what they have, you know, we call cognitive reserve. You know, there's a whole variety of things. And it would be so interesting because when I'd see some of these patients, at first, you couldn't tell anything. They come in the office like, hello, a lot of the times, and they were just totally normal until you started doing the testing. And then sometimes they would do some tests perfectly well. And then you'd hit upon their like particular deficit.
And you'd just give them like a card sort or something. And they're just perseverate. They just don't do it.
Yeah. And you're just like, wow. So, but it's like almost like they've compensated, especially, you know, depending on how long they've had the lesion
and how you know, how intelligent they were.
Yeah, like how much cognitive reserve. Yeah.
Did they go to college beforehand? Were they in a like upper middle class family where they had a lot of good education? And they, you know, it's like, it's unfortunate because you definitely see these changes too along socioeconomic lines and you see them along poverty lines. And it's a huge bummer to see somebody who's like already not had a fair shake then deal with a blow, you know, deal with some sort of injury or illness. And then it's just like, it gets worse for the worse at that point, which is so sad.
And it's unfortunate. And I, you know, it's funny. I'm doing another paper now where we looked at people like mild traumatic brain injuries. Mm-hmm. So it's like they've had some sort of trauma to the head. But when they go in, they do just a regular structural MRI. They don't see any like gross lesions. Mm-hmm. And so they send them home and like, oh, you're fine. But they're still having all these problems of like they can't pay attention. They're having impulse control problems. So we actually went in and did a more refined, it's called structural DTI or diffusion tensor imaging, which can look at like the white matter connectivity.
Oh, so you can see if they've like sheared a bunch of axons.
And then we picked up huge differences. But you know, like when you go to a typical like emergency room or hospital, they're not going to do that more like refined, sophisticated imaging. It's more expensive. It's more, you know,
they're going to do like a CAT scan.
Yeah. A lot of them had CTs.
They're just going to look for like a brain bleed. And if they don't see blood,
and they just like send them home, or if they don't have like a real, you know, they'll some, you know, do an MRI. Mm-hmm. But if there's no damage, and so when we looked at them compared to, let's say, you know, people who had no brain injury, huge differences. In particular, when we measured impulsivity, their impulsivity highly significantly correlated with white matter degradation in the connectivity between the prefrontal cortex, called the forceps minor. So it was like a clear connection.
So basically, like their tissue was okay in the frontal cortex, but it couldn't talk to any other parts of the brain.
Yeah, the connectivity, and it's the shearing effect of the white matter, just the way the brain is like being shook in the head.
Yeah, because if you like, you get in a car wreck, you get hit playing a sport, you get this twisting head and motion injury. So not only does your brain bounce around in your skull when it twists.
Yeah.
Imagine that you have like a beautiful tapestry that's a little bit brittle, and then you twist it and you snap a bunch of the threads in it.
Yeah.
Like that's what's happening in your brain.
Exactly. And so the reason I brought that up is because like when you're talking about the, you know, the socioeconomic status of people, so a lot of what I got, interestingly, from reviewers from that paper, because I was saying, look, this is great. We can actually see that there's something to, like there's a neuroanatomical correlation to their symptoms that they keep complaining about.
Yeah.
And some of the reviewers said, well, and I mean, it's a legitimate point, but well, these type of people who had these head traumas, like maybe it was a motorcycle accident or whatever, well, maybe they're impulsive to begin with. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're not, you know, they're risk takers to begin with. So that's why they got the brain lesion, you know, and it is hard to disentangle the pre-existing, let's say, personality types, you know. But if that's true, then unfortunately people who have less opportunity, who are in more dangerous situations, who have to do more high-risk jobs, you know, are going to be the ones more likely to get their brain injury, which is going to cause them to be more impulsive. So it's this kind of like catch-22.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, it's very hard to do like a pre, you know, and post, because you don't know who's going to have, you know.
Exactly. Like, because you do clinical research in human populations, you can't like lesion people.
Exactly.
See what happens after.
I mean, the closest you get is like when you neurosurgical studies, when you know they're going to go in for a particular, you know, procedure. But usually by then, either they have an abnormal brain, because either they have a tumor growth or they've had epileptic seizures.
Yeah.
And so they're not a normal, you know, quote unquote brain. So it's always that kind of catch 22. But, you know, I always do. I mean, I grant that criticism. But either way, these people are still having these problems. And the more we can give it, even doesn't mean that it gives it more legitimacy just because we can find the neural correlate, but it's just putting the pieces of the puzzle together.
And I think that, well, first of all, it makes it more scientific, which is always interesting and important, especially when you're trying to tease away how you can help treat people, is the more evidence you have and the more that you can actually point to what's going on, the more I think you can lead to positive treatments and positive outcomes. But it also, I think, as the patient, gives you something to hold on to, because so often when you're dealing with psychiatric, especially psychiatric illness, but even probably organic kind of illness that comes along with, like we've been talking about, cancer or seizures or a bump on the head, you kind of really blame yourself, or you think that like there's behavioral things you could be doing that would fix it. And a lot of times there's kind of not much you can do.
Yeah.
And so knowing that, oh no, this is because my brain is doing this. It's not because of how I'm just acting, can be really, I think, comforting, mm-hmm. you know, on the psychological yeah. side of things.
Yeah. Cause it's this, but there's still a stigma associated mm-hmm. with like people with psychological disorders. Like there's something wrong with you, like the yeah, person.
Or like you're just not thinking positively enough.
Right. And, yeah. It's like, so that's so frustrating because the brain is just another part of the body that happens to be tied to our whole concept of self, you know, so we're intimately tied to it. But like there should be no more stigma about having some kind of brain problem than there is of like breaking your arm or having, you know, a brittle bone or whatever. Yeah. And if you can look at it like that, you know, it takes away a lot of that stigma. So I do agree. Like, so while a lot of, you know, I don't think that all the answers are, you know, if we can see what's the actual correlate in the brain, that's not going to solve the whole problem. That's why I'm interested in the psychological treatments as well, like, mm-hmm. you know, ERP or, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, because you have to deal with that aspect of it. But knowing it, how it works from both perspectives, just gives us more ability to come up with better treatments. You know, so I just like, I think just MRI information is not enough, and just looking at the psychology is not enough. If you have both, like with the neurofeedback, or you know, you can deal with your feelings of disgust and look at your insula activation, you know, combined can be better than just one by itself.
And what an incredible tool for the patient themselves to be able to, I don't know, kind of like regain some control, regain some sense of independence, and mm-hmm. also actually feel like they're working toward treatment. Because sometimes I think what frustrates people about talk therapy, even though it's so fundamentally important, especially if you're struggling with a mental illness or you're dealing with some sort of like intense life event, you know, transitional life event, mm-hmm. sometimes what's frustrating about it is it's kind of like there's no end. You know, it's just like, oh, I just yeah. do this for the rest
right,
of my
like,
life.
Is this working?
Yeah, like, what's exactly. Like, am I better? Right. Like, is that a thing? And so actually having outcomes and having, you know, physically seeing the feedback is like amazing.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's very satisfying just like as a scientist, because I have like two, I guess, my scientific perspective and my clinical mm-hmm. perspective. And now I'm actually doing training so I can see patients for treatment as well as for research. So I really, and I think the clinical work informs my research and vice versa. But, you know, giving people something, yeah, exactly. You can now, let's say there's some studies where we want to look at the brain before, let's say, cognitive behavioral therapy and then after mm-hmm. and see actual physical changes, like more activation, let's say, in the prefrontal cortex. For me as a scientist, that's very satisfying. And it's also, you know, clinically speaking, nice for the patient to say, like, look, this is something I can point to that's tangible, that like I'm making progress. And, yeah. You know, there's something for me, at least, you know, it's very satisfying.
Yeah. And I think for a psychiatric patient, especially, like, it's cool to see that we have this practitioner-clinician relationship that's in many ways shifting a little bit, so that patients, or I mean, I don't even know if I want to say patients, but just anybody, people, mm-hmm. you know, you get sick, you go to the doctor, whether we're talking about a mental illness or, you know, a liver disease, right. you go to the doctor, and to be more empowered about your own treatment and to be like, wait, what's wrong with me? Can I like read about that? Oh, what are mm-hmm. the names of the drugs I take mm-hmm. and what do they do and why do I take them? Like those kinds of things are so important.
Yeah.
You know, and so few people, at least historically, I think we are starting to see a change, but it was not uncommon for me in those few years where I was doing just that basic clinical work that mm-hmm. I'd be taking a history and I'd be like, okay, so what are you taking? They'd be like, I take 7 pills. And I'd be like, okay, so what are they? And they'd be like, well, I think there's 2 for my blood pressure and like 1 for my heart. And then I don't know, the other 3, I can't remember what they're for. I'm like, well, what are they called? Like, I don't remember what they're called. I just know mm-hmm. I take like 3 in the morning and 4 at night. And you're like, wow.
Yeah.
And that's really common mm-hmm. that you just, it's just like full trust. Mm-hmm. Just, if this is what I'm supposed to do, I'll do it. No questions asked. And I like that people are becoming more empowered to like
yeah.
want to be in on it. Like, show me my film.
But
show
then it's, me my... I know. But then yeah. it's almost swinging, the other pendulum is swinging the other way. Like, because I get so frustrated when I see like the commercials on TV for like, ask your doctor about this medication. Like, you're not a dog, you know, and then like patients will come in and they think they know. Like, I had an OCD patient who, I mean, you know, the thing with the OCD patients is like they're obsessive. So yeah. they're like obsessively reading. Like, this guy read every article like on the disorder. And he was like, okay, so I was reading this article by so-and-so. And like, I want to get the neural implants, you know, like, because we do. Yeah. The deep brain stimulation as like a last resort.
Yeah, you're
treatment.
Like, we're not there yet, honey.
Yeah. And he's like, no, but da-da. And he's like citing all these papers, and you know, and you're like almost like, so it can work against you. Like, when there's so much information, patients come in and they think they know everything about something, you know, more than someone, let's say, who's had many years of education and experience
and seen hundreds of patients with a similar disorder.
Yeah. Because
that's part of it too, is just wisdom.
Right.
It's hard to have wisdom about yourself.
Patterns. Yeah. No, you don't know. And so, or like, you know, seeing a commercial on TV and being like, I want to try like this, you know.
Well, that kills me the most. You know, we're one of very few Western nations where it's even legal to have. Yeah. And I remember, you know, Bill Maher used to always say, it was part of his stand-up routine, and I always really took it to heart. He's like, he was really doing a scathing indictment of these pharmaceutical commercials. And he's like, when I go to my doctor, I can't remember, I'm not going to verbate it, but when I go to my doctor and I ask him, you know, if blah, blah, blah is right for me, is he my doctor or is he my drug dealer?
Right.
Because like, it's not your decision, the meds that you're supposed to take.
Yeah. I just find the whole thing so ridiculous. And then they're like, and this can cause like death and like, you know, your skin can fall off or whatever. And people are like, so try it, you know, and you're like, what?
And it always causes a horrible side effect to the exact thing it's supposed to treat. It's like, do you have slightly annoying seasonal allergies? If you use this nasal spray, your brain will bleed out of your nose. But like, and you're like, I don't know if that's like a risk benefit thing.
But you might not be sneezing anymore. Like, so take your chances.
It's so crazy.
I know. So like there are pluses, there are, you know, benefits and pitfalls to having a more informed.
It's interesting. Yeah. Cause I've never really been on that side of it. I can't imagine.
You're like, it's all good. People inform. They want to know more. And you're like,
and you're like strangling your patients. Like, you go be quiet. Just listen to what I have to say. That's so funny. Yeah. That would be really, really tough. Ugh.
Yeah.
But it is still, I mean, in the general sense, I do always advocate for like more education. But it is hard because also we live in this echo chamber where, as you know, we talk about this a lot, like in the skeptic community, this echo chamber where like you can basically read anything to suit whatever your thoughts already are on the internet.
Absolutely. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like when you want, I mean, it's like anything, even, you know, climate change, right? I mean, I'm like, there's all this evidence that is happening, but like if you choose that you don't want to believe it for whatever political reason, whatever you're motivated, you will find the things that support what you believe. And it's
they'll like, seem legitimate.
Right, right. Yeah. And so I think so a lot of, you know, the problem with the studying the brain and the mind is that it is a science, but it's not an exact science. Mm-hmm. It's still in its early days. I mean, we know a lot compared to like even, you know, 50 years ago or, you know, when the main treatment, like when we were doing like maybe electric shock therapy, and which still is a legit therapy. It's got a bad rap from films and stuff, but it's almost like it's not very specific. So it's like if your computer isn't working and like you just turn it off
you
and
reboot.
Start it up again, that's kind of what it is. And then all of a sudden it works. You're like, I don't know exactly what happened, but something kicked in.
But for like super severe kind of intractable depression, it does seem to be, some people swear by it.
It works for people. Like it's, but now, you know, we're doing like, with, I mean, although it sounds, you know, brain surgery sounds like a big deal, but it's pretty minimally invasive. Mm. And when you do the deep brain stimulation, you know, it can help. And it's like a more targeted ECT.
But well, we used to like actually cut holes in people's skulls to let the bad spirits out.
So yeah. we've come a long way.
Yeah.
But you know, so like it's all relative. So given that, like we know a lot. However, there's so much subtlety in the human brain and in behavior. Like there's no one treatment that suits all. And that's why it is a little bit different than like, let's say, I don't know, having high blood pressure or where you just take this pill and it's very specific. You know what you're decreasing or increasing. There's no one medication that suits all. Depression can be very different in different people, different causes, different chemical imbalances, different neurocircuitry involvement. So that's why to me it's fascinating because it's so complex and there's no like one answer. But we're going further and further and further. We're learning more and more. But that's why I still think a clinician is like a clinician. They have to know the science, but it's also an art form.
Yeah, just like being a physician, you know, it's important. Like I do wish that I was literally just talking about this with my shrink earlier today. I do wish that our views on clinical science were more scientifically focused. Like I definitely think we should do away with a pre-med undergrad. To me, that's insane. Mm-hmm. I think kids who end up going to medical school should have biochemistry degrees or, you know, comparative anatomy degree or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. Like they should have at least a strong science undergrad before they go into the more clinical kind of focus, which is like almost just as much an art as it is a science. Yeah. But that said, it makes me wonder because I'm totally on, you know, Team Heather with this. Right. I was a psych person before I got into neuro and I kind of want to go back to psych. And so I wonder what your perspective is because you're in neuro now, but you're, like you said, you're trying to go back and get all of your clinical cred
right,
so that you can actually see patients, not just for research. How, but you also know the skeptic community.
Yeah.
And you know the like rigid, like anti-psychology rhetoric that you sometimes see in like anti-therapy rhetoric. Like, what does that, I don't know, how do you respond to that? And what does that feel like for you sitting on kind of on both sides of that fence?
Yeah. So, I mean, at the heart of things, like I want evidence, right? To show that this treatment, let's say, is working. So when I was looking into possible different paradigms of what kind of clinical training I wanted to do, I was, you know, because I've written a lot about the integration of neuroscience and psychoanalysis. Like, do any of the psychoanalytic, and I know the skeptic community like does not like psychoanalysis. But I said, okay, can we use the modern tools of neuroscience to investigate in an experimental way, these concepts from psychoanalytic theory to see what pans out.
Yeah, I mean, some of them have to be testable.
Yeah, and
maybe we can put them to bed, or maybe we find support.
Exactly, exactly. So I didn't go into it like thinking I'm going to just try to like prove this to be true, but just like a very open mind. And you know, I wrote this, like I went through all the literature and wrote this like pretty comprehensive review paper about what's out there in support or not. And the things that seem to be supported via neuroscience is like the neural basis of suppression, like keeping a thought at bay or a memory or, you know, an unpleasant emotion. We can actually understand that at the neural level.
Interesting.
There's experiments where you have people like, you know, don't think about this. And we can see like what it is to keep a memory at bay, to keep something at bay. We can look at the neural basis of dissociation. So kind of like what you were talking about with your tattooing, where you can kind of like almost, it's like a coping mechanism to leave your body when you're either feeling physical pain or emotional pain. And then, you know, I've done some experiments with people who have then disorders where they're like depersonalization disorder, where they're completely dissociated. They can't get back in.
Yeah.
So what turns out to be a coping mechanism can be, you know, become a clinical problem. But we're seeing neural correlates of those things. So that I find really interesting. But for me, in terms of the pure clinical aspect of it, it's like, what works? I only want to do like evidence-based treatment. And that's what my kind of, where my measure is of what I'm going to do. So like when I look at things that work, well, things that can, and also things that I think can be helped by therapy. Like I worked with schizophrenic patients who were, it was my first internship many years ago, actually when I was like just finishing undergraduate. They were schizophrenics who were in the psychiatric emergency room at Bellevue in New York, addicted to crack cocaine. You know, they were severe, and we were trying to get them off their cravings for crack cocaine. And after working with them, I said, you know, you can medicate them, you can help like curb their symptoms a bit, but we're not going to cure these people. I mean, this is like severe. And so and some people like to work in that space.
Yeah.
For me personally, I want to work in a place where I feel like there is a proven treatment that can actually, has been shown experimentally, that can help people. And for me, it's like the anxiety disorders, the kind of phobias, like this exposure response therapy helps people. Like with OCD, if you don't want to, like, I don't know, touch the toilet, you know, you can over time, you have to expose people to what they're most anxious about. They realize over time, they relearn that you don't have to fear it. Nothing bad happens, and they can get over it. And you see those behavioral changes. Yeah. And so for me, that's evidence that it works.
And they have like positive life outcomes from it. They stop washing, they stop counting, they stop harming, whatever those things are. And actually their lives are better because of it.
Yeah. And so for me personally, that's gratifying for me in terms of where I want to be on the therapeutic side of things. And I think it's completely legit. Like I could, at any skeptic, you know, conference or whatever, I can completely defend this as like, look, there's evidence that shows this helps.
And the cool thing is, I mean, it's probably also the frustrating thing is that like, you know, academia may not have caught up to that completely, especially in psych and especially in the more kind of clinical sides of psych. Not the research sides of psychology. And so it's got to be self-guided. It's a decision you make. You know the kind of clinician you're going to be. You know the kind of researcher you are.
Right.
And you can ensure that because you have such a strong scientific foundation and you know, even on the activism side, like what matters, you know? And if anything, maybe you can bring that to the department and bring that to the program with the questions that you ask, with the way you interact with your peers in the program. So like, I think anybody listening who especially is on the more like social sciences side of things has always had this thing where they take a class and they're like, is this woo?
Right.
Like, I'm confused. What is my professor teaching me? Like, is there evidence behind this? And they get frustrated and then they like have this existential crisis of like, what am I doing with my life? And it's like, no, you can be kind of a beacon for change in that area. Like, question it. Like, speak up in class and make it a philosophical conversation because we don't have all the answers. And
exactly.
So lots of times we fill in the gaps with history.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that history isn't really well vetted.
Yeah.
But it's like we're doing their best. And I think ultimately all of these institutions want to see evidence-based work.
Yeah.
Because why would you want to keep doing treatment knowing it doesn't work?
Exactly. Unless you're in some kind of dogma. I mean, there's still these like little pockets of, you know, like I'm going to stick to like hardcore psychoanalytic, you know, theory, which, as I said, there are some good. There's, I mean, Freud was very insightful in terms of picking up on these things. But, you know, it can get a little bit
it can
much.
Get bad.
And some people are like religious about it.
But like even my shrink will do things like it because like I don't talk. Like I'll show up and he'll be like, what are you feeling? And I'm like, don't fucking ask me that question. You know, and then he'll do like little free association, like practice game. But it's like it's just a way to get you to talk.
Yeah.
Like there are a lot of things that came out of psychoanalysis that like are just they help.
Yeah. And there's still things we don't know why. Like we talk about experimentally, mm-hmm. like when you're comparing, there's studies that compared the different paradigms, like different types of therapy. So like, can you compare psychoanalytic treatment to cognitive behavioral to like more like ACT is like a more recent kind of version of therapy. And the thing that they find is that a lot of the time, regardless of the therapy, like itself, it's the therapeutic relationship. There's something about having the relationship with that person that is helpful. And that's the like fudge factor, like why that is or what that is. And that's independent of the more like experimentally validated, like what paradigm you're actually using for the treatment. It's just, you know, the relationship you have with your therapist. And so there's something to be said for that, you know?
Yeah. If you go to a situation where like there's an abused child,
mm-hmm.
and you know that this child is abused and you see the evidence of it and this child hasn't had a lot of warmth in their life and you give them a big hug.
Right.
It has an immeasurable outcome.
Yeah.
I don't know how you quantify that scientifically.
Right.
I don't know how you see the difference in the pre-hug child and the post-hug child mm-hmm. and how you actually make a spreadsheet about that. But
right.
there's absolutely no denying that there is a difference and that there's an effect there. And so those are the things that we have to start to tease out. And a lot of it is about improving our psychoanalytics.
Right.
It's about how do we test for these things and how do we, you know, our psychometrics, that's what I meant to say. How do we test for these things and how do we actually compare them? Because it's more difficult. It's more difficult when you're dealing with people too. This, I always get frustrated because I'm a biologist and kind of somebody who has some background in psych. I actually have more background in psych than bio. I just have a more advanced degree in bio.
Mm-hmm.
And I argue with my bio friends a lot about like, you know, everybody's like gives psychology a bad rep. Like it's a fucking soft science, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, do you know how much more rigorous the statistical methodology has to be when you're dealing with people?
Yeah.
Because we can't just clone a bunch of people and then like stick spears in their heads and see what happens. It's like,
yeah.
You can do that with mice, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know,
it's like way easier.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be so much more rigorous like with what you do. But even studies show like, let's say with neglected children or children with really bad childhood, what, like there's people who are looking at resilience now, like what makes some people more resilient than others or, you know, trauma. Why do certain people get PTSD and others who had that same experience don't? And one of the key factors is even if you had like, you know, shitty parents basically or whatever it is.
Or no parents.
Or no parents or, you know, abusive parents. If you have at least one person in your life that you can form that bond with, whoever, a teacher, a neighbor, whatever, that is a really big protective factor. So like it's akin to like your hug or whatever. It's just knowing that you can form that attachment to somebody that they're, you know, a healthy, positive emotional attachment. You know, it's like you can show that statistically that that's important and that can make a difference in terms of whether someone develops PTSD or not.
Yeah. And perhaps that is that X factor with therapy. You know, it's having an advocate, really. Like, you know, it's funny. My shrink's so funny because I remember one time, like, I was, like, not in a good way. Right. And he was, like, being really nice and saying nice things to me. And I was like, whatever. Like, I pay you to do that.
Oh, God. Yeah. There's still in the back of your mind. Yeah, like, I'm paying for you.
I know. It's like, I'm paying for you to be. And he's like, you might pay for me to be here, but you don't pay for me to care.
Oh.
I rolled my
that's
eyes.
A good line. I got to remember that if anybody ever. True. But I mean, like, that's the side of it. But the science side of me, like, still, I think integrating what I know about the brain and how it works is a huge part of it. So if you can take that, you know, the psychological perspective and integrate that with understanding how the brain works and the neurochemistry, like you really do get a full picture of a human, even though you still can't completely predict behavior or it just, I think there's no one perspective that's going to give you all the answers.
There just can't be. Yeah, it has to be multidisciplinary. It's too fucking the brain is too complicated. It's like saying that it's like in quantum mechanics trying to find like a grand unified theory. Like we know Einstein knew a lot and he had a lot of things really right, but there's still holes.
Yeah,
there are holes with gravity. Like we're trying to figure it out, but like lots of times it takes taking multiple perspectives and sort of finding the best of the best and conglomerating them in that way. Yeah. I have to say, and I tweeted about it yesterday. Mm-hmm. So last night we went out to dinner with some friends, Heather and I. I'm saying this to you, the listeners, not to Heather. You're like, yes, I know. And we had some really great conversations. And when I got home, I couldn't really sleep because I had like two Mexican Cokes. And so
I was like, what's a Mexican Coke? You're like, it's in the bottle. It's in the fancy bottle.
The best. And so I was flipping around Netflix trying to find a documentary to watch. And usually I watch like super depressing documentaries, like I watch a lot of crime documentaries and I watch a lot of like sad geopolitical like conflicty documentaries, which are rough. And I was like not really into that last night. So I had seen previously Jennifer Siebel Newsom's documentary called Misrepresentation about how like females are really not represented in positions of power in media and also like in government. She has all these great interviews with, you know, like Gina Davis of the Gina Davis Institute, who does a lot with like trying to improve the Bechdel scores of films, but also Condoleezza Rice talking about like, do you know what it's like being the only pair of ovaries in the fucking war room? Like it's crazy. And so that was great. And then I saw, and I've known this for a while, and I don't know why I haven't watched it. She's a new movie. And I bring this up to you both because you have a little one on the way, but also to people listening because I feel like it was really transformative, called The Mask You Live In. And it's about boys. And it's about how as a culture, we socialize boys not to feel. And we teach them that it's not okay to cry. And we teach them that if they are going to have an emotion, it has to be anger. And then we reinforce it and reinforce these gender roles. And then it's if a boy gets in a fight at school, they're not really punished. But if they, you know, are a pussy in front of their friends, they get made fun of. Mm-hmm. And then we're surprised when 90% of violent crimes are committed by men, you know, and we're surprised. And we never talk about the way that we socialize gender and how that actually leads to those kinds of outcomes or is highly correlated with those outcomes. And it was fascinating. So I just like, I know it's a bit of an aside, but I think it kind of comes into play with some of the clinical science stuff we were talking about. But I highly recommend it to anybody listening. The Mask You Live In, it's on Netflix, so you don't even have to pay for it. anyway, I wanted to, because it's like, gosh, we've been going a long time. I wanted to talk to you about some of the fun stuff that you do outside of the lab, because you have your lab.
Yeah.
At Mount Sinai, in New York. But you also do a lot in media. Like, I met you because we did an episode of Star Talk together, which was so fun. On stage.
And for live a live audience. Yeah,
that was really cool. And so I know that you've been a regular guest. You've done Neil's show and you've done a lot of, like, fun, cool science stuff where you're a guest on these things. But even more lately, you've been doing a lot of cool on-air work. So I'd love for you to tell me about, like, your show and some of the other fun stuff you've been doing.
Yeah, it's cool. So I did this Discovery Channel show called Superhuman Showdown, where we went around the world and I met people with these extraordinary abilities and we kind of did experiments with them to see how they can do these amazing things like hold their breath underwater for 22 minutes. And
holy
then,
shit.
Yeah, it's crazy. Oh, like God. They like record-breaking people. So like what's going on with them? Is it? Yeah. And then there was like a competition aspect of it. Like we were like, you know, on a panel and it was myself, a neurosurgeon and a sports physiologist. And
cool.
Like, who's the most like superhuman in this particular category, you know? But it was a lot, it was interesting. I mean, so that was a lot of fun. And I did that show, and that was Discovery International. And then more recently, I'm doing a show called Science Goes to the Movies, where we review films, but from a scientific perspective. And it's just a lot of fun because everybody loves films. And it's not just like science films. It's like there's science in everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, we would can review like Birdman and talk about like what's the neuroscience of hallucinations, you know, or so there's always something. And we'll have guests on, we'll have guest scientists, or we'll have on like, you know, we had like Bill Nye, the science guy. We talked about climate change and disaster movies. Neil came on and, you know, we'll have certain like guests that'll give us their insights into the films. Or we, for example, we did X-Men and we had a geneticist and we talked about mutations.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And it's just a nice way. I feel like the films, everyone is interested in films and it's a nice way as like a platform to get into the science, but it's still fun.
Yeah.
So we were doing that with CUNY TV and it got picked up by PBS. So now it's showing, I think, in like half the country and also online. online.
So you can find it on the PBS. I love the PBS app.
Well, no, it's actually on, I don't know if it's on the PBS app. It just started airing on PBS. It's on CUNY TV app. There's an app for actually Science Goes to Movies has its own app.
Oh, nice.
So you can actually just download that app
and then just watch
all the episodes. Cool. And it's a lot of fun. Like some of my favorites are, we did Ex Machina, and we talked
about that movie so much.
Like artificial intelligence. We had on as our guest Christoph Koch, who's the head of the Paul Allen Brain Institute, who's doing a lot to like map out the genome to see how it tracks onto the genes that track onto brain development. And it, I mean, it's an amazing work that they're doing there. So we talked about that. And then we had a blast from the past. We talked about Blade Runner as well as like an artificial, which it's like
so
a
good
uber like geek movie that's like cult. But like, you know, so it's a lot of fun.
Did you guys do The Martian?
We did The Martian.
I watched it on the plane again 2 days ago when I flew back from New York. Yeah. Because I was like, I have to.
It's great.
So good.
Just that line, like, we're going to science the shit out of this.
I know.
When I saw that in the trailer, I'm like, I got to see this.
Well, I was one of those nerds who, like, read the book really early. Right. And so, like, I didn't even know a movie was being made. So I had the luxury of reading the entire book and envisioning Mark Watney as, like, whoever I wanted him to be. Like, he wasn't Matt Damon in my head. But then I was so glad that they did cast Matt Damon because he was so great at it.
Yeah.
And, oh, my God. It's just so good.
Everyone loves Matt Damon. It was great.
I cried again. Like,
really?
I was
you cried at The Martian?
I cried at The Martian for sure. When they like captured it and they were able to pull. Yeah, I cry. Wow. I'm a crier.
Well, it's like, I just feel like it's the, like, you know, science wins kind
it's so good. I know that is the protagonist is science.
Yeah.
And that's really what Andy Weir said about writing the book, is that the reason that he did the dust storm at the beginning, knowing that it's not physically possible for Mars to have wind gusts.
Yeah, we
like
had
that,
a whole conversation about that.
Is that he was like, I needed nature to be the antagonist and I needed science to be the protagonist. Like, the whole goal was
like
that you solve a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you have, like, nature's a bitch. She's not going to cooperate. And then you have to fucking solve the problem.
Did you know he like crowdsourced the answers to
Isn't that amazing?
Like, that's so cool.
Yeah, he put the book online chapter at a time and like
got feedback from people.
Nerds read it and gave him feedback.
Like, what would you do if this, like, how would we solve this problem?
And
we
some of them were like JPL scientists who were like, no, it would never work that way. You have to do this calculation, or like, you should use hexadecimals.
Which is so great. Cool. I love that. So yeah, we had on a planetary scientist, Professor Stuart Johnson, who is at Georgetown University.
Oh, cool.
We actually happened to be graduate students together back in the day, and we were housemates in England.
That's so random.
And isn't that random? And I like remembered in the back of my mind, I was like, I remember this cool girl lived in my house who was studying Mars. I wonder if she's still doing it. And I like looked her up. I'm like, oh my God, she's now a professor and like studying it. And she was at JPL for a while and she did like amazing stuff. So she came on and she like knew. It was amazing, her knowledge of Mars, like the geography and the names of things. And like, they had it all right. Because she'd be like using these terms like, when they went from like the, I don't know, I'm going to make up names, like the Rivendell Canyon
over to like Acidalia Plantitia or something. Like,
and I'm like, holy
places.
Shit, you know these names. I mean, it was just.
And she probably also was able to correct that, like, JPL don't really look like that.
Right.
Like, once they're in JPL, it looks legit. Like, when they're in the big kind of, like, warehousey looking buildings and everybody's, like, wearing, like, schlumpy clothes because they haven't slept. Like, that's totally JPL.
Right.
But when they walk through the, like, fancy. It was weird.
Oh, wow, that was.
I know. A dinosaur just fell off. You've probably heard this like three times. I live in fucking LA, so there's helicopters everywhere, but they're really loud today.
They're usually not
that bad.
Wow.
Yeah. Up here, they don't fly over so close, but I think that's why that dinosaur
fell.
You
think from the vibration
of
the
helicopter? I think so. Or maybe he was like precariously placed up there.
In your perfectly aligned shelves. Super jealous. You got to like post a picture of these shelves. They're just amazing.
I probably should. Yeah,
you really, honestly, before they get messed up, like this is like the pristine condition. I want you to do it before and after.
Where like entropy has like come into play.
Like, this is day one. This is 1 year later. Like, what happened?
I know. Cause like, we've lived in the house for a while now, but we didn't have any of the shelving built in yet. So it's like all the books were just in boxes, which is also why anybody listening is probably hearing a slight improvement week after week of the audio.
Oh.
Yeah, because it was so fucking echoey in here when I first moved in, but now I've got all the books to absorb
the buffer it. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. And I have these panels too, but I'm not sure
Oh, are they like sound?
Yeah, they're like baffles. So I'm going to hang them or I don't know yet.
This place is really cool if you can see it. It's just awesome. Oh, but the other thing I wanted to say about the science and the films is that the other thing that I'm doing in like outside of the TV or being in front of the camera is behind. And it's actually the reason I'm out here in LA is the National Academy of Sciences has this program called the Science and Entertainment Exchange. And I'm in this committee where we bring like real scientists from NASA and, you know, like professors who are experts in their particular field. Together with like Hollywood writers of like, you know, the X-Men and Star Wars and a lot of sci-fi stuff and TV series as well. And we have conversations with them. We, if they want advice about something, they, if they want to be true to the science, like kind of like what happened in The Martian, the program will connect scientists to the writers. And it's just a great like program. And it's just wonderful to see some of the suggestions get integrated into these films where you can really have an impact on a large scale. Because I mean, like popular media. So like one of the things that our program did was they had the writer for, it was like the Thor movie. Mm-hmm. And they convinced, like, I think the Natalie Portman character was going to be like a nurse or something, whatever. And like, why not make her like a physicist or, you know, and they did. And then, you know, or just integrating
Zach
more.
Zach Stentz. You wrote that movie.
He's exactly. Yeah. You know him. That's what I mean. He's one of the people we're meeting tonight for dinner. We're having our annual meeting.
He's wonderful. He's actually kind of, because he is so close with the Science and Entertainment Exchange, like he's like a science nerd. Yeah. And so he's actually become friends with a lot of the local LA science crew. And we do these like soirees every month. And he always comes to, well, when he can, comes to the soirees. He actually went to SciComm Camp, which is a science communication retreat that I organized with two of my friends in Malibu. We're starting to do it annually. He came last year and was on a panel talking about science at the movies, which was so great.
Yeah. And that's what I love that, like the integration and getting like the science out there to like just in mass like popular culture.
It's the only way that people will really start to absorb it en masse. Like we all struggle as science communicators with preaching to the choir. And like those of us who are most successful at our craft are able to sort of get outside the bubble and affect change that way. But the truth of the matter is, until we see it in mainstream media, there are just people who will never be reached.
No, they just, they're not caring. They're not interested. They're not like looking online for the science information.
Yeah, they're just not even there. Like you just don't have a conduit to them. But like everybody fucking watches movies and everybody watches TV.
So it's like our secret way to get in.
Yeah.
So I love that kind of stuff. Like there's the behind the scenes and meeting. So we have this annual dinner now. Like we've actually had a writer's retreat where we all went away together for like a weekend in Arizona. And we actually, the scientists, we all got 20 minutes to present whatever we happen to be working on that might spark ideas and these writers, and we just got to know them and we all became friends. And so now we have this annual like meeting where we all get together and reconnect, and it's great.
Have you been asked yet to be a science advisor on
anything? I have. A few things. I don't know if they're going to integrate my ideas. Like one of the shows I actually haven't seen, but it's called The 100. It's a series on the CW. I advise for that. This new film from Stan Lee. He does the
comic books.
He has the Gamut Marvel. Is a character. Okay, a Marvel character. That's not the word I couldn't think of. Yeah. thanks.
I was like comic books.
I know. I was like, what?
I know.
Marvel. Yeah, he's like a new Marvel character. So he's gonna be Channing Tatum.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
He's gonna be starring in it.
And he's so good.
Yeah. He has his own, I think, production company now or something. Yeah, but I got anyway. I got contacted by producer for that, and they were asking me like, how can we make it legit? I mean, I do get some funny questions that are like, you know, we want him to be able to like move objects like with his mental energy. Is there like a scientific way we can explain that that's legit? I'm like,
and you're like, that's bullshit. But it's like, and the truth of the matter is like the way it works is you give them what you give them, and then they decide whether or not they're
right. But you know, I think it's like I give it, and the same thing what we do on Science Goes to Movies. We're not trying to like necessarily point out the like what they got wrong, like you know, like the dust storm on Mars didn't happen. But it's, I mean, we can point that out, but it's not about that. I think, you know, it's creative license. Obviously it's not going to be 100% true, but it's a way in. You know, you might even, it might get you to ask that question, like in Interstellar, like if you went into a black hole, like you're not surviving, you know, you're gonna like be spaghettified.
Yeah.
But like you might ask you that question, like when you go there, like is that real, is that like, what could that really happen? And then you might go and look it up, and then you might actually see the real science. So I don't think that like a film has to be like legit in terms of like the real, like they're not documentaries, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But if it gets people curious or excited about like space exploration or whatever, and then they want to look further, I think that's important.
Our friend Spiros did some advising on Ant-Man, and of course, like nothing in Ant-Man could actually happen.
Right.
But when he does go to the quantum realm, they wanted to make it realistic. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, we want to go quantum. What does a quantum physicist tell us it should be like?
It's so, and we actually reviewed Ant-Man, and we had quantum physicists mm-hmm. on. We talked about like microbiology and mm-hmm. like just all, you know, what happens on those small scales.
And it's like, of course, like you can't put a guy in a suit and then he controls ants. Like that's stupid.
Right.
But like when he does get really small, like what would it look like if you could be a quark? What would the world around you look like?
And
like, are there things
about, like,
that are springy and floaty?
Right.
And yeah, it's like fascinating.
Like the oxygen molecules would be too big for you to breathe in those tiny lungs. So that wouldn't be possible. Like things you don't think about, right? I was like, yeah, that's true.
That's crazy. Like, I love that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff it allows you to, like, it opens the door to get into that. So I don't think like it has to be legit per se. So like when I gave the advice for Gamut, you know, I was like, look, this is like maybe like if he touched something and like the physical molecules like move to something else. I don't know. I was like trying to come up with anything that could be somewhat like real. Like who knows what they're going to go with.
You're we'll like, see. Just don't say he is now using more than 10% of his brain. Oh, God. And then I'll
kill myself with that movie. Yeah, that killed me.
And that's where you can see why these kinds of initiatives are so important, because there's so many easy things that if you just had a science advisor, just look it over, you could at least get rid of the things that are glaring.
Yeah.
And especially when they're not in service to the plot. You know, like you can make changes that make things a lot more realistic. Look, Killer is like, so will you sweet. Be my mommy?
Oh my God. The dog is coming up
I love
to me.
That. I know.
So
he's like, you guys have been talking too long, which is probably true. So I'm gonna close, but I'm gonna ask you first the same two questions I ask everybody before the end of the podcast, and they're kind of big picture, so I apologize in advance.
Okay.
So they're related. The first one is a bummer and the next one is not.
Okay.
In whatever context that is important to you right now in your life, whatever, whether it's personal, whether it's familial, or whether we're talking about big picture global things, I want to know first, what is the thing, the biggest thing that sort of keeps you up at night, that makes you worried about the future? But on the flip side of that, what are you really inspired by and optimistic about and looking forward to?
Wow, these are big questions.
I know, they're horrible.
There was
I'm
no
so
pre-advanced
mean.
Preparation. You didn't like let me even
no,
think about it
I'm
for
never,
a second.
And it's funny because sometimes I'll have people on the show where it's like a whole episode about climate change. And I'm like, what are you worried about? And they're like, fucking climate change.
Right.
Which is like, funny. I dedicate my life to this.
Yeah. It's funny because the first thing that did come to my mind was climate change. It's just my husband's a rapper. He raps about science. His name is Baba Brinkman. And his new show is Rap Guide to Climate Chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So vicariously through him, I've gotten
learned
a lot.
Yeah.
And it scares me a lot. So that is something that is currently bothering me. But really, like, my lifelong kind of thing that has kept me up, and it was the reason I became a neuroscientist. And I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again.
Good.
But I distinctly remember I was around 5 years old. I for the first time, I realized that I was going to die, like, in a real way.
Mm-hmm.
Had my, like, feeling my own mortality. And that completely freaked me out. And I still have like this fear of death. Like I don't think anybody like wants to die, but I really just don't like that concept of not existing. So I couldn't sleep all night, and I thought, okay, well, maybe if my body doesn't exist, can I still, and I can't talk to anybody else or whatever, but can I still just have my inner like thoughts, you know, can I still just think to myself? And so the next day I said to my dad, who's a physician, where do my thoughts come from? And he's like, well, they come from your brain. And I'm like, okay, great. Well, how? Because I want to figure out how I can try to keep them when I die. And
your dad was like, oh my God, I love my daughter.
He was like, what? I mean, like, first of all, what the hell, 5-year-old? I guess I was very like existential at the time. And he said, well, actually, we don't know exactly how. And I said, well, what can I be when I grow up to like figure that out, because I wanted to like basically cheat death? And he was like, from his medical worldview, he was like, well, I guess like a psychiatrist, you know, like he was like, I'm like, okay, well then that's what I want to be. And so I remember then, like in first grade, I wrote my essay, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was like, I want to be a psychiatrist because I want to figure out where my thoughts come from so I can keep them when I die. And they were like, holy shit, like
so like, dark.
Yeah,
but like, also a freaking like, super genius.
Well, it could have gone either way. So what they actually did was they sent me to the school psychologist and to like do all these tests, which was like the best place for me to go, because I was like, oh my God, this is like fascinating. They did like all tests on me. And so because it could have went either way, like either they were going to put me in like a special, you know, like place for kids with like issues, or like luckily, thank goodness, like because honestly, I really it would have changed my whole life course.
Yeah,
but they put me in like they had like whatever they called like a gifted program, but it was like I got to one day a week go to this special school and take like advanced classes in like psychology, in biology, in like all this great stuff, which was totally stimulating for me and exactly what I needed, and it opened me up to this whole world, especially the psychology part. I was so interested because normally at that age you wouldn't be like taking something in a class in psychology.
You're not even really aware that it exists.
No,
at that age.
No.
Like learning your colors, maybe.
Yeah, it was like not. It was so that was like one of the best things that could have happened. But that question, that existential kind of question of like, where do my thoughts come from? What, like, how come when I would work in, with patients going under for like brain surgery, like when they go under, where do they go? How do they come back? Like, where did the, I was just talking to them a minute ago. Next thing you know, they're gone somewhere. We're working inside the brain. Then you close it up and you like bring them back. And so like I have this fear of like anesthesia. I don't like anything where I lose consciousness.
Yeah, me too. That's partially why I don't drink.
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
like I would see people like blacking out in college and I'd be like, why would you do that to yourself?
Right.
Like it's really scary.
That's why, yeah. Like, well, I used to be less scared of drugs when I was younger, but now like.
Oh, it's true. I would do drugs because I was really into expanding my consciousness, but I was not interested in knocking like out my consciousness.
I don't want anything that's going to make it like I'm not conscious.
Yeah.
That's scary life as to shit. Me. Like being aware is being alive. And when you're under anesthesia, you might as well not be alive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the thing that keeps me up at night is well, I guess it's like a fear of death and wondering still this fundamental question of what like we call the hard problem of consciousness. How does our physical brain, like neurochemicals slushing around and these neurons firing, create our subjective experience? Mm-hmm. That's like one of the most interesting.
It's like we know self comes from brain, but how?
Right. Yeah. And we still don't know. We can make these correlations, but we just don't have the fundamental
Yeah, we know
answer.
Like what percentage of brain activity you have to have in order to be conscious. We know the difference between levels of consciousness on a Glasgow coma scale, but we don't really know like
why it is that
what the spark is.
Matter. And, yeah. So that's I guess that was like, I guess,
I
the more
that.
Dark side. I don't
so
know.
Yeah, what are you looking forward to? What are you really optimistic about?
What am I really optimistic? I feel like now I'm such a dark person. Let's see. What am I
You're
optimistic
like, nothing
about?
Nothing matter.
Well, I mean, my honest answer at the time, I guess it's of course, I'm very excited about scientific discovery, okay? And I think stuff with like neuroprosthetics are amazing. I think there's this whole new thing called optogenetics where you can go in and use optics to like control neurons firing in specific circuits. All that stuff is really cool. That's like my science optimism stuff. Optimistic that we can have genetically like CRISPR where we can modify genes and like maybe cure cancer or help us live longer. I mean, if we can extend life, that would be really cool within my lifetime.
Yeah. So then selfish. We could just keep working on the problem.
Brain. Yeah. Then we could just give us more time. Like, I just think I feel so bad. Like, it would suck if we found a cure for cancer, like, and you like just missed the deadline, you know, it would just suck. So I want to be able to extend life long enough to like figure things out.
Yeah. It's like all those people that are in cryogenically frozen right now, like, and we don't know like the one like we haven't like made the compound yet that's absolutely necessary to be able to like unfreeze somebody. It's so depressing. It's like can't bring them back.
Yeah,
but everybody after August 17th, 2030.
Yeah, you're exactly. Good. So I mean, I'm optimistic, hopefully, that we can do these things, but the real like emotional answer. So that's like my kind of scientific optimism. But like honestly, like my daughter and my like upcoming child is like seeing what happens with them in the future. For me, it's just like it used to be like about me and what am I going to discover and whatever, but now it's just like I want to live long enough to see like what they do, like how they thrive, like how the story unfolds.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that's the real extension of life. Like they're kind of like, in a way, they're just like your replacement. Like you're going to die out and they keep going, and like watching them develop into the people that they're going to be. Like,
and
I'm
you have
really
such
excited.
A hand in that.
Yeah. I mean, a little, but also I feel like they on like, there's not, I feel like that we can help guide them, but I like, you know, my daughter was born with like a certain temperament and like she stayed that way. Like, it's amazing how I feel like they're born into the people that they're like meant to be. And we can just sort of be there to like help guide them. But they're,
yeah, you're like a facilitator. But what you do have the power to do is like totally ruin them. So.
You could fuck them up a lot. And then they're going to need hugs from like you. Like, I'll send them to your house.
It's so funny how it's true. Like, it's this tenuous thing where like, you know, you see it in the therapeutic environment a lot, where like just having parents that love their kids is so important
just the
for healthy development.
Like feeling of unconditional love that you are loved. And even if you, I mean, kids are going to mess up. Like, you're going to be, I mean, like,
kids are like, they're kind of retarded. Yeah, like, it's, you know, it's like they're not, their brains aren't developed yet.
And even, you know, my grandmother, who took a large part in raising me when I was like a rebellious teenager, because I was a handful, I admit. But I remember one time, I forget what I did. I snuck out or whatever. I came home and she wasn't mad, whatever. She just said to me, and this was like, it stuck with me to this day. She goes, I'm not going to punish you or nothing. She goes, I just hope that one day you have children that are just like you. And I was like, oh shit.
And now you're like horrified.
I'm like so scared. Please don't be like me. Please don't be like me. Anything but me. And it was like, she was like, she put a curse on me or something. Like, and that really straightened me out too. I was like, oh my God, I better like get myself together, because if I have someone like me, I'm not going to be able to handle it. So, but I mean, like, I'm optimistic to like watch their like futures unfold. And that's just so exciting for me.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, Heather, this was so much fun.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we finally did. It's so weird that we haven't done this before. I can't believe it. But let everybody know. I don't know how active you are in social.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, where can they actually find you? And also, where can they watch? I mean, I know you mentioned the show before, but like one more time, just so that as they're leaving, they can go like, oh, I want to find Heather.
Yeah. So I'm definitely, I'm active on certain social media. Mm-hmm. So like Twitter for sure. I'm at Heather_Berlin. And I have Facebook. I have, but Twitter is like my main thing right now. Yeah. I don't know. I'm probably going to get into Instagram and that kind of thing. But
I'm with you. Twitter's number one for me.
I'm less of like a picture kind of person, and I like content or like putting up a link or a commentary. So I like that substance. So.
I agree.
That's me. So yeah, Twitter. And Science Goes to the Movies. You can find it at online right now at cunytv.com under the Science tab.
Cool.
And you'll have a link. And then we also have an app at Science Goes to the Movies. We have a Facebook page and we have a Twitter account as well.
Very cool.
You can find it at lots of different places. But the app is really great. You can download it on your iPhone and just like watch all the episodes.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's so great because like increasingly so many of my listeners will be like, how the fuck do I watch the stuff you do? Like, I don't have cable.
Right.
And you're like, sorry. You know, so it's so nice when a show doesn't have those restrictions and can like just exist on Tate.
Yeah, and you can watch it anytime you want. Yeah. Like, I mean, of course it airs at certain times, like on CUNY and on PBS, but like to be able to just do it at your own convenience or you're on the bus or whatever.
I love that.
I mean, I love it myself. Like if I want to catch up in an episode that I missed.
Awesome.
Oh, I also have a website, heatherberlin.com.
Nice. And that covers both your clinical and like science work and also your public kind of SciComm.
Yeah, exactly. Very cool. You can find all my research papers, the PDF files are there. So it has like my whole research stuff and then
Like
links to like, you know, TV stuff.
No paywalls here, baby.
Yeah. You can all science for free.
Yes. I love it.
So yeah. And then you can find a lot of video content and like, you know, stuff I've done. Like
Very
our,
cool.
I think our Star Talk is on there, the video. So you can catch that.
You guys, go check it out. It's actually really funny.
I love that.
It was really good.
Because
it was what? Who was there? Eugene Merman.
That's right.
And
the comedian. He was from the show
Wyatt Cenac.
John Stewart. Yes.
Wyatt
Cenac.
Yes, yeah. I loved him.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And of course, Neil is really funny too.
Yeah.
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 So yeah, guys, check it out. Say hi to Heather on Twitter. And once again, Heather, thank you for joining me. This was so much fun.
So much fun. We could talk forever.
For sure. Yeah. I know. And everybody listening, thank you guys so much for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.